this term is just going through and lopping off all the one particle reducible graphs, and so that you're really summing all the vacuum graphs, which all depends on phi, because phi, when you expand this thing in powers of the fluctuation, the quadratic term, and so all the propagators and all the interactions will depend on this background field. So all the Feynman rules are phi dependent in principle, and background field dependent, and so these vacuum graphs contain the information that we're looking for. But what we did last time was we said that it was useful to imagine separating the measure, which was the product over all modes, to some choice of modes. So if we, at a different point, C. So if we had chosen expanded phi of x in some sort of a mode expansion, with some basis function u, which were typically chosen to diagonalize the quadratic part of the action, blah, 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 then this measure was a product of the integral over all these coefficient functions, and it would factorize into, we could choose to factorize if we said that low energy was, so we've got some operator acting on u, we go to some eigenfunction in u, and we could define low energy to be omega less than some arbitrary lambda, we could define high energy to be omega bigger than some lambda. Then, with that choice, this would, we could divide the measure into a low energy and high energy part. We have one of low energy. And, that allowed us to, given that we were going to focus on, if we're only interested in low energy observables, so we choose J, the similar extension, let's call it B for J. D to K equals 0, K satisfies. So we choose not to couple the current to anything which is a high frequency or high energy in this definition of high energy. Then we could write that thing as E to the I gamma F phi as integral of phi low energy. E to the I is Wilson action. I probably don't want to commit myself to doing that. Or even the I Wilson acting, actually probably, is just the integral d phi high energy. Yeah. And what I'm imagining doing here is when I write it as a sum, I'm thinking this is really, I could have thought of that as being phi plus phi low energy phi high energy. We've done the integral over that, but what's left is the sum over the low energy part, which is whatever the cold is. This is a definite. And what was useful about that definition was, from the examples we looked at, that because of this, because we're defining this split based on energy, and in a relativistic system, that also would mean that you're, if you're discriminating against high energy, you're also discriminating against high momentum in a relativistic system, but that won't necessarily be true in non-relativistic systems. The discrimination based on energy had two good things going for it. One was that if we only start off with a system involving low energy modes, we evolve it forward in time, we didn't expect to produce energy modes because energy conservation, but that's about it. So it's self-consistent to think about the interactions of low energy part of the system, because conservation laws will keep you there if you start there. And the second thing was that the influence of the high energy degrees of freedom that are not in your low energy theory, they play a role because there's virtual processes where they're exchanged and things like that. But because of the uncertainty principle and because these things have been excluded on the basis of energy, their contributions are forced to be local in time. And to the extent that it's also true that you're excluding large momentum as you would in a relativistic system, they're forced to be local in position. This kind of thing we're going to find has the property that it's real because the evolution in the low energy theory, the Hamiltonian we get from this action is going to be some permission because you start with these states, you stay with those states because of energy conservation. And it's also going to be local because of this uncertainty principle statement that the replacing the effect of the heavy particles to any fixed order in an expansion of 1/1. The precise statement was, we can always capture the physics of the heavy particle exchanges in terms of some operator involving light fields, and that's kind of what this is. But the important content of the uncertainty principle is that if you choose to look at this thing as a power series in 1/1 the heavy scale, 1/1 lambda, or whatever the scales are that we're ignoring, then in the limit that we stop that series at some fixed order, which we'll see is all we're going to do later on, this thing will be local. In general, it's not local. It involves propagators from one point to another, depending on wherever these heavy particles went. But in the limit where you're doing a pivot theory for fixed order in 1/1 the heavy thing, it's local. And to the extent that those two things apply, that it's real and it's local, then the things that we're describing here are very much like the things we start off with here. They're just things that we would have been entertaining as potential classical Lagrangians. It's a general, local, real set of interactions. In the examples we looked at, we chose a renormalizable interaction, and that's kind of an additional assumption we made, probably the only additional assumption we made that hasn't been a property of the Wilson action. But you'll see that that's something which is not required of the Wilson action, but there's a sense in which you can understand why renormalizable interactions will play an important role down the road. So what I'd like to do now is where I'm going is I'm going to go back to our example and calculate the Wilson action as possible in the one loop level, or part of it anyway, in this one model we've been working with. But before I do that, I don't want to actually use this definition, because the problem with this definition is that it involves a cutoff. I could have actually explicitly written that. I should have probably written a comma lambda here, because this thing, the split between low and high energy part is something which depends on the details of how you define a low and high energy part. And it doesn't depend on just one parameter either, because there's lots of ways you can discriminate scales of high energies. And so there's a whole raft of potential information in the definition of this action. And where was I going with that? The point is that this I don't want to use this definition because it's actually working with cutoffs is actually not very efficient because it's not a once you're doing loops it's not very efficient because a lot of the power as you'll see of the complete power of this kind of description is that you have to be able to use it and you have to be able to identify what's the some fixed order in 1/1 the heavy scale what are the terms in this that are important in this action, and how do they depend on the parameters of the underlying theory, if you have the class plot. And you'll see that the way you address that is a power counting thing, I'll get to in a second. You want to know there's some fixed order in the 1/1 energy expansion, or 1/1 heavy thing expansion, which interactions are the ones that can contribute. And so I'll come to an argument which will tell you which interactions are the any fixed order are the ones that are relevant. And you'll see that an important part of that argument will be dimensional analysis. And what makes the cutoff not useful is that it's polluting the whole dimensional analysis argument because it's a scale which is by assumption large compared to all the light scales we're interested in, but it's smaller than say the heavier scales that were in the problem, the real physical masses. But the one thing we know about lambda is that it's not in the answer, because at this step, there's no reference to lambda, because lambda was all to do with how we chose to divide up the integral when we were doing it in one step at a time. But the answer doesn't care how you do that. The answer is just something that's completely lambda independent. So the one thing you know about the things you're calculating is that they don't depend on lambda. But you've made dimensional analysis hard because you've put in a big dimensionless variable which is not in your answer. But if you're just counting dimensions, nothing stops this lambda from appearing everywhere. And so what you're interested in is following how physical, big physical heavy mass scales appear in your answer. And lambda is not one of them. And so it's always useful not to use a cutoff. Because of that, basically because of that reason. So what I want to actually do in the example I'm going to do is to do this in dimensional regularization. So I want to take you to where the scales like lambda will appear, but they'll only appear as logarithms. So the powers of scales will only come as physical particles rather than as cutoffs. So what I'd like to do is two things. I want to just really briefly swing by the exact renormalization group. Because if you kind of ask, what's nice about this way of defining the Wilson axiom is that it's conceptually clean. It's kind of, it looks like it's very simple. It might be complicated in practice, but in principle, it's a very crisp statement of what the Wilson axiom is. And so there's a, so you'd ask, what's it good for? And I think that the reason that I'm not going to talk much about it in detail is that in practice, people don't use it much in calculation. But it is true that you can say things about the most useful things that have been said in this context, I think, are the ones that are based on what's called the exact renormalization group, and that is that it's an efficient statement as to how lambda appears in this action, given the criterion that it has to drop out of physical space. And so what I want to do is a brief detour on telling you what the exact renormalization group is, and then I'll leave that there so you've seen it, and come back to the evaluation of this thing in dimensional regularization. So that'll involve explaining how you can use dimensional regularization in effective action, given that dimensional regularization includes all possible momentum right up to infinity. And so it seems funny to have a dimensionally regularized action. If this was a dimensionally regularized path integral, it would be including momenta, which were arbitrarily high here, which is, seems like it's in disagreement with the what we're trying to build into this concept of the Wilson action. And I'll explain why that's not crazy, and then show you how you actually calculate this force of action in dimensional regularization with this example. And after that, we'll do power pattern. So I want to take a detour here to the exact renormalization group. This is my question. So an observation, so this is an aside. Tell the exact renormalization. And this is based, what I'm talking about is based on largely on the paper. There's a literature on it, but I'm basing it on paper which is so old it doesn't have an archive number. So it's using the normalization. It doesn't have an archive number, but it's been, I can give you the Harvard sequence number, but it's been 1983. So what he's doing in this paper is he's besides defining this normalization group, he's using it to prove, he uses this is being applied to a scalar field theory, you know, 5 to the 4 field theory in 4 dimensions. And he essentially shows how to prove that it's a renormalizable theory without using any of the fancy things that you would have done in the 50s, like the Weinberg theorem. And it's a very physical way of saying what you mean by renormalizability in this type of Lagrangian kind of picture. And the kind of the logic of the exact renormalization group is similar in spirit to the renormalization group we're going to find in other ways of defining the Wilson axiom, so it's useful to see. So the first thing is to be precise. So what we want to do is we'll take a we'll consider a specific for the purposes of this aside simple field theory. There's one real scalar, and we want to pick the I'll call it phi. And we'll want to write our Lagrangian density to be with minus 1/2. I'm going to write it differently in a second, but minus 1/2. We call it m naught squared, phi squared, minus 1/4 squared, lambda naught. That's morally what we're going to start off with as our Lagrangian. But I'm going to be more precise about what that means in a second. So the first thing is we want to do this split. And so what Polchinski does and what I'm going to do, I'm going to follow, is we'll write this, you know, we wanted to write things in terms of a basis which diagonalizes the quadratic part of the Lagrangian. And so implicitly what we're going to do is we're going to be doing perturbation theory where we're going to take this piece as being the quadratic piece of the Lagrangian, and that's the unperturbed part. We'll perturb in this thing. And so that means that the quadratic piece of the Lagrangian has the form of phi, some operator phi, and that operator is if I integrated by parts, it would be box minus m squared acting on phi. And we're doing this in flat space, so the mode functions u sub k that are going to come in will be just plane wave, vdi kx. And so so the useful basis for making a split will be momentum space. And the issue that, in the momentum space, the analog of omega k here will be, p squared plus m squared. And you know that the conversation we had in this last week was that p squared in the Lorentzian signature is not positive definite because it's minus energy squared plus momentum squared. And so what we'll do is we'll work in the Euclidean signature where we've made the, taken time to I time, so that p squared is positive, and so that the criterion that the frequency be large or small compared to lambda is discriminating energy and momentum. That's kind of framework in which we're working. So I said those words last week, and I'm just going to do that here now. And so what's going to be useful is to write this thing in momentum space. So if I wrote the action as being integral d4x of L, I could write that in momentum space as being I'm going to leave a space here for something I'm going to write in a second. We'll have an L interaction. So the S interaction is this thing. And this I've just written in momentum space. So 5x, it's an integral d4p over d5-4 dvi dx. And I've left a space here because I want to do this discrimination of high versus low frequency. And where I'm going here is that I want to focus on the integral over the low energy mode. So I want to focus on the integral momentum from zero to little lambda. And so I want to be precise as to what the split of low energy versus high energy means. And what you And I want to do it in a way that he does it, but he's doing it in a way which is avoiding a problem, which you might not see when you first do this. If you just kind of looked at Feynman graphs and you took pointing at a Feynman graph like this and you said, well, that's something which is, there's momentum flowing in, there's momentum flowing out. I could choose this momentum here to be Q. And then momentum conservation says that this has to be, you know, Q minus T. And so the Feynman rule for this would be something like the, you know, some coupling constant G here, and say G here, we have G squared times an integral D4P divided by 2 pi to the fourth. We have a propagator, which is 1 over T squared M squared, and another propagator, which is 1 over T minus T squared plus M squared. Sorry?
Thank you. Using amplitudes. Or this kind of thing?
The reason I'm writing it down is that what I'm describing is a cutoff. And so what you might have said that the natural way to implement this in this Feynman graph would be to say, well, I have an integral here. I'll cut it off at lambda. So I'll ask that T squared be less than lambda squared. That's the natural way in which to find this about the cutoff. But the problem with this definition of a cutoff, which is probably what you would have used if you were have been cutting off integrals and loops before, is that it actually depends on the answer you get will depend on how you chose Q. You could equally well have said this is Q minus 1/2 T, and then this would be that minus T, so it's plus 1/2 T, this would be Q minus 1/2 T. That's another common choice, where you have a symmetric kind of choice, and then you would have had here, you know, Q minus 1/2 T, Q plus 1/2 T squared. And if you had done that, and you chose this, in this integral, the choice, the same limit on Q, you get a difference because you're not integrating over the same region, because the choice of Q that you're putting through the loop here means that the ones that are close to the cutoff are not exactly the same in these two different ways I've chosen to label Q with. And so there's a just cutting off, and that can actually play an important role. If you use a cutoff in practice to identify what your effective action is, you're cutting things off in different ways where you've rooted the momentum differently, you will find different answers. And you'll find them at the low orders in the expansion in powers of lambda. You might have thought this is something which is always suppressed by powers of 1 over lambda, this difference. But because things are diverging, and you have positive powers of lambda in your things you're calculating, this kind of a choice actually will make a difference in the kinds of things you're calculating. And so that's called rooting dependence. But if you cut things off in a graph, it depends on exactly how you cut things off. So the way you avoid rooting dependence is you impose kind of more geometrically what your cutoff is. So the warning, thought here was warning, answers will depend on how you root momentum through the graph. That's one of the reasons why the action doesn't depend just on a number lambda. It depends on the details of how you discriminate against the type of things you know. This is about rooting. You sometimes see this in old papers. And it's often a surprise when you see it for the first time. So what Polchinski does is kind of a more of a geometrical thing, and that's what people normally do when they're really setting these things up, is what he really wants to do is he wants to not just take some integration variable and cut it off. He wants to require that for every line, you can't have momenta that are above the whatever is discriminating low from high frequency. So what he's going to do is he's going to change the propagator. The propagator, which would have been the inverse of this thing in the quadratic action, is actually turning itself off for frequencies that are above this cutoff. So he puts in a function here, which I'll call K inverse. Let's just divide by K. T squared over lambda squared. With the idea being that K is equal to 0 for T squared much bigger than lambda squared. 0? Yeah, so as a propagator, when I invert this thing, the propagator is going to turn itself off when T squared is big. The K will be 1 when T squared is much less than lambda squared. And then he doesn't really need to say much more than that. So K is some function that does this. You know, it turns itself off for some momentum near lambda. So if I keep dropping K against so its derivative will have the property that K d lambda, let's say, will have the property that it's doing nothing except for in some interesting range of region around lambda. So that's what this statistic K is. It's expressing how the cutoff is done. And in the paper, he kind of goes, when he's proving renormalizability, he shows that nothing he's trying to do depends on anything except for these two properties. It doesn't depend on the details of how you actually did the cutoff. But in principle, when you calculate the action, it could depend on those details. So that's what K is. So now what he does is he sticks this into his action. What he really wants to do is he wants to write this is what the classical action was. I'm interested for the purposes of making. He's interested in something different in his paper, but if you I want to think about we're trying to do this path integral, and I want to just basically apply Polchinski's definition to the Wilson action, not the classical action, and all that just means is that I have to be more broad-minded as to what I'm going to allow myself to think of here. So we'll think of the Wilson action being defined in this way. And so the Wilson action would have plus Hundredson and Hundredson now. It won't just be this lambda not phi naught squared. And what Polchinski is interested in doing in this paper is expressing this Wilson action will depend on lambda, and it does explicitly here. But he wants to identify the lambda dependence of the Wilson action is, by definition, one which will cancel with the lambda dependence in the functional measure. So if you're calculating this path integral graphically, you're doing a bunch of Feynman graphs. The integrals that you're doing in the Feynman graphs are diverging, such as that one. They were no longer going to diverge because now, in the Feynman rules, if I use this as my unperturbed Hamiltonian, now I can integrate from 0 to infinity. But each propagator has a factor k in it. This will be k of whatever the argument was here, 2 minus 1 half 2. The way I've done it now. And so this thing is going to be turning the integrand off for large momenta. And so these things are all going to be convergent integrals now, but they'll depend on the details of lambda because it depends on k. And so the explicit integration is involving a k dependence. And what we know about the Wilson action is that its dependence on the details of how you discriminate against the high frequencies is such that that explicit cutoff dependence is canceling the cutoff dependence in the action itself, because we know that the one thing we know about little lambda is that it's not in the answer. So what Polchinski would like to do is to express that as a differential equation, a condition on these integrations, on these interactions. And the interactions that we have won't be lambda independent, because it'll depend on exactly how we set things up. And so what you can do is you can imagine changing lambda a little bit. If I move lambda from lambda naught down to some smaller lambda, the difference between the Wilson action before and after will be just coming from the integration over that small range of wavelength between the two cutoffs. And so if I ask, how does the action change? If I demand that this action have the property that nothing physical, like this dancer we're calculating, depends on the value of lambda, then that's a condition that tells me I can set up that condition that the physical answers don't depend on lambda as a differential condition on these interactions in the way that I'm about to do. So, but the logic of it, I want you to see the logic before I get into the details. So what we're going to do is we're going to change lambda a little bit within this framework where we just have some fixed k, but we're letting lambda change. And we'll ask, how must the interactions change as a function of lambda to ensure that the answer that in the path integral doesn't change at all? And that, that'll give us the condition that nothing changes as lambda changes. It will be a differential condition on this interaction term. And that's telling you how the interactions are changing as you bring the cutoff down from scale. And so he's interested in proving renormalizability. He'll be interested in, as they go down to very, very, very low scales, there's only going to be a few of these parameters are going to be important in the end of the day. But in general, if you want to ask what's important at any scale, you can ask it in this way. You can ask differentially, how does the action change? And then integrate the equation to get the other couplings involved down at very low energy. Any questions about the logic of what I'm about to do? The consequence of what I'm about to do is that the large volume scenario is wrong. It's unstable. I'm trying to drive the people from the door. Sven like that. So let me, kind of the T line is just as a definition. Let's write this e to the I, di gamma. So it's an integral over phi. And I'm no longer writing the low energy, because we're all about low energy, of the exponential. And I just want to now write out what the fraction is with that definition of quadratic plus indirect. So, and we're doing it all in the Euclidean signature, so I can write the e to the I gamma. So we've got the integral e4p. Of course, I'm going to write this in detail because the condition that things cancel, you see, has a nice simple way of writing. So first, I'm going to write out the quadratic part of the action that we had, the e squared times m squared times this divided by this function that's cutting things off. And then we had the current term, this one here, which I'll write in momentum space, j over p minus p. Close that bracket. That was the momentum integral. That's the unperturbed part. And then we had plus the interaction term. Close the big bracket. And I want to emphasize that this will depend on lambda. It depends on phi and also depends on lambda. Here, all the lambda dependence is explicit. And J has the property that its support as a function of momentum is turning off before you get to lambda, because we're demanding that the currents that we apply are all only seeing long wavelength degrees of freedom. So that's what we're trying to calculate. So we can calculate the derivative. We can take lambda dd lambda. Let's call this z. So z is this. And so if I just do the derivative, it's the integral phi of lambda df is your x. E to the minus. Well, I'm calling this whole thing, to follow the potential notation, I'm going to call this vector plus lambda, e to the plus f, so call this thing e to the x. Normally I would have called it e to the minus f, but let's do this because I don't want to deviate from this notation to give you all quick sign errors if I do that. So you see, all I've done is the differentiate this thing. An exponential pulls the argument down. The lambda dependence here is here, so that's explicitly differentiated. And then there's the lambda here.
It didn't depend on lambda. Because this P, I'm imagining, so we got we have lambda here. K is
like this. The J is something like this. I get to choose my observables, and I'm making sure I'm
not. I don't look at anything near the trial. I would suppress by something, but that's my choice of what field configurations I can look at late times. But I'm always assuming that those are much, much. I'm never looking at any energies that are at all close to lambda, because I want lambda to be much bigger than all the scales of the lower G term. So if I now change this, this is being held fixed.
Does that do the same?
All right. And remember, this is also something which, because K is doing this, derivative of K is all localized near lambda. So that this, anytime you see this in an integral, the integral is really only seeing values of momentum near lambda. So in particular, J, if I had J in this integral, the answer would have been zero, because J vanishes when this is not zero because of difference. This is K. So this would be
J d lambda. So if this is J, then the product of J times this would be zero, because they never are both not zero.
Just not really sure.
You
not sure where it comes in. It's true that the things depend on J, and that's kind of why this depends on pi. That's one of the reasons why this depends on pi.
Okay, but originally we had action that depended on the background field plus for the pi.
Yeah, when I call it phi, so there is really this whole thing is not phi. It's the thing that's in the argument here. You're worried about the phi.
I think I'm finding the right thing.
Yeah, because I'm making actually a. I'm not thinking of.
When you switch to momentum of space, right? Isn't there some issue there?
No, what I'm doing is I'm assuming basically that by doing this in flat space, I'm perturbing around a constant field background. But I want to calculate the perturbations, the position dependent perturbations. So if I was actually going to evaluate this, try and actually really calculate what the integrals are, then I'd have to force myself to look at I don't want to be able to calculate the propagators. If I had a background which is exactly constant. But what I'm trying to do here is instead of making up an argument in principle, an argument about principle, I can think of any action as something which I can take any field in the action and regard it as being zero. I can expand it around the zero field. And it's not something which is necessarily going to convert very quickly. But I'm imagining I'm never going to tell you exactly what test is. I'm not going to write explicit power expansion. I'm going to write a differential equation for it. And so when I do the perturbation series, I think this is being unperturbed and this is being perturbed. What I'm really doing is expanding around your field.
But the dependence on the background field is still there because the current I would need is still tied to this background field. But I'm just not organizing the thing that I didn't do here was actually write this as being quadratic piece and the perturbation piece and say this is the unperturbed part and this is the perturbed part. And that, I could have chosen. The way I was making the arguments last week, I was doing a suspension around phi. I could have chosen to expand around something else. And then the things I said about canceling one particle reducible graphs wouldn't hold anymore. But I'm not going to actually talk about it last minute. I could choose to divide this into underperturbed and disturbed any way I like. And this is the way I'm going to do it today. And so things I said last week about perturbed versus one PI versus one particle reducible graphs won't necessarily hold in the way I'm doing the perturbation today. But I'm not going to use those in the argument I did.
Includes the background field, or maybe...
Yeah, it's the whole argument of the action.
Okay.
It's the thing that I'm integrating over. So the way I think what's bothering you is saying that there's...
It's as if I take a pi equals zero here, but what I'm really doing is I'm burying it all into J, and I'm putting it in different place. The way the step before this, I had an action which is e to the I, phi plus I, integral of j plus phi minus phi. Right, that was when I was calculating then I just shift the variable to get this. I could equally well have calculated e to the I double. Maybe that's the thing, that's probably the thing I should do. I think the plusivity is there. Let's write this, w of j. Then we don't have to have the time to do. And the argument I'm going to make is going to be equally good because
all I'm really using with the left-hand side is that it's something which is not changing as Legendre changes. And the Legendre transform, the details of exactly where to put J2 is not supported. But this will be clearer, yeah. Any other questions? That was a good question. Alright. Now, I'm telling you this is something which should be zero.
So that's a condition on what this is. And to kind of, so in his paper he writes down the answer. But you can kind of see where the answer's coming from if you kind of ask, why was this thing independent? It should have been true that in particular free theory didn't change, right? If I had had a free theory as the full theory, this path integral is Gaussian and I get the free theory. The one loop correction would have been a constant, which I'm going to ignore anyway. There's no higher loop because it's free. And so this Wilson action would be equal to basically the classified and not to an additive constant if we had turned all the interactions off. So if it's true that this is zero,
Well, it's like zero point energy, right? It's something which that.
Just a circle.
Yeah, although so you could write it as a circle, but really that's dangerous way to think about it, because this makes you want to think it's the integral d4p of the propagator. And that's not the one that we're answering, because it's traceable out of this. Oh, no, I deliberately don't write it as a graph because of that. Bryce would write it that way, and I almost failed my qualifier exam because 3 weeks before I did the exam, I wrote this graph down and I tried to evaluate it this way. And I only caught the error 3 weeks before the exam. But that's kind of error you write down, and someone says, you know, you don't understand anything. So don't do that. So the bottom line is that if this is zero, we should be able to see this is already
zero separately without having to think about this. In the limit where S interaction is zero, it filters this is going to go. And so I want to see, I want to write this in a way which shows you why it's vanishing. So,
if that is zero, just DZ.
Oh, it doesn't make a difference, really. It has the advantage. Normally you do this when you're writing. This is a convenient thing to calculate because it's dimensionless. And typically, the things you find are going to go like powers of lambda. So if you take down lambda, you have the thing that comes down is just the power. So it's a convenient way to write it if you didn't have to. So the thing to do is probably stop laboring the motivation and just write down the answer and then show you. It's going to look like it came out of nowhere, but its motivation is that it's grouped in a way which is showing you why the first term was vanishing. And the idea is to use
the identity that you show that lambda z d lambda is equal to zero. Use the identity that the integral, the functional integral of the total derivative of something, so let me write this delta phi of d d s. So if this had been an ordinary integral, this would have been something which is depending on the endpoint. But in the functional integral, the boundary isn't affected by when it's zero, or you've chosen kind of a asymptotic boundary conditions at infinity. So what I want to do is I want to write this thing as a total derivative of something. And that that can be done for this, because we have it as an explicit function of phi. And what we'll demand is that this is has the same form as the explicit function of phi is here. So let me write the answer. So what we'll do is we'll choose. I'm just writing what he's written in, and then and the words I'm saying are kind of where this came from. We'll choose lambda, the S interaction with lambda, the minus integral equal t. If we demand that this is true, so this is a statement about the interaction terms only. And the rationale for it is that this is what if I had to ask what the unperturbed action satisfies to make this total derivative fit to this. So if I had asked for all of S and not just S interacting, I would have, that's what's telling me how to write this. So this becomes lambda. Z lambda is the integral equal t and lambda a d lambda the integral phi of delta phi of phi of t the inverse of t phi So what's going on there? So imagine that we had applied, we tried to calculate this set of derivatives for the where we had no interactions in this term. What I'm using is that if you have delta phi of e to the s would have been delta s delta phi d to the s, right? Take two derivatives. Squared of EGS, and that would have been EGS times delta F delta phi delta F delta phi plus delta 2 F delta phi. So this thicker combination of things is coming in because it's recognizing that if you have an exponential and you differentiate it twice, then you pull down products of first derivatives or second derivatives. And if I had taken the quadratic part of the action over there and apply these derivatives, basically I would have gotten, and this factor here, for instance, is being chosen because the second derivative of the action with respect to phi doesn't depend on phi for the quadratic part of the action. And this is designed to cancel that. And then the other term here is corresponding to the first derivative squared term. So the first derivative is linear in phi. Two of them will be something quadratic in phi. And that's the kind of thing that you would have had over here when you just differentiate here twice. So this thing here was quadratic in phi. And so when I say that the derivative, if I ask the free part of the action, if I ask, is it satisfying this? The answer is yes, up to this term, because the thing involving this dd lambda of the action is quadratic in phi, and that's corresponding to this term here. The extra piece, which is not there, is being canceled by this term here.
So, because it's the integral of the total derivative, by that thing, it's zero. So this property of the interaction action is ensuring that this is zero, regardless of the interaction. Any interaction that satisfies this will satisfy this. In particular, S equals zero satisfies this. S interaction equals zero. Any questions on that? Graphically, if you kind of ask,
in terms of the graphical cap integral, what's going on there? If you had a graph with a bunch of external lines, and there had been a, somewhere there was a vertex for the thing that went across, and there was some other thing, then there's two ways in which a heavy line can appear in a graph. It can appear where it connects two different vertices, or it can appear in a graph where something is going on, and somewhere there's a line, and the heavy line connects to the same vertex. If you were to take this thing and make it really, really heavy, so if this thing has a cutoff dependence because it's really described by k of t squared divided by t squared plus m squared, if I start changing lambda differentially, so differentially with the k, I'm picking off something which just sees this thing near p squared equals m squared. And so it's taking this line and evaluating only at very high frequencies where it becomes effectively, in position space, it's shrinking to a point. Because in momentum space, it's becoming independent of p. And so the replacement of this by an effective interaction of the form where these light guys come in and touch some new effective interaction, that effective interaction that involves four light fields, which I got by contracting that line, is being described by this term here, where it has two independent interactions. Whatever you had, so supposing the way I drew this was a cubic interaction. So I differentiate that interaction once more, and I get something which is a quartic interaction. And I'm kind of saying that wrong. Yeah, I'm actually not saying it quite right. The statement is that if you actually, if you evaluate that path integral using the Feynman rules the way we described earlier, then the interpretation of these two terms, the one involving the second derivative of the action and the one involving the two first derivatives of the action, is that this is something where the propagator is connecting two separate vertices, and this is one where the propagator is connecting the same vertex to itself. And so graphically, the first term there is the replacement of this line by this new effective interaction. So you're growing this effective interaction as you change lambda. And this line would, of course, the second derivative term would have corresponded to taking, supposing we had more things coming into that. It would have corresponded to replacing that vertex by, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Instead of having something with 7 vertices, this heavy thing has been removed and replaced by a new effective vertex to resolve two fewer things because we differentiated twice the effective field compared to what we had before. This involves taking, I'm making this sound hard, but all that's going on is that supposing we had S interaction went like, in this case, by cube because it has 3 things in it, then the derivative, d phi, would have gone like phi squared. If I multiply 2 of them together, I get something which goes like phi to the fourth, and that's this effective quartic. If I had something involving, you know, S interaction went like phi to the seventh, like here, then if I take 2 derivatives, that goes like phi to the fifth, and that's this thing. And so this is describing how effective interactions are being obtained by contracting in position space these heavy particle lines. But it's not being done this way of describing it in graph. It doesn't rely on the graphical equipment. If you could do this path integral in a computer, you could define this. So this is solving the exact normalization group. This is telling you how the interactions have to depend on lambda in such a way that as you change lambda, physical things with low energy don't care. And what Plotinsky does in his paper is he uses that property to show that as you go to very, very, if you integrate that to very, very low lambda, very small, then what happens is that in coupling constant space, you have a, you know, if you imagine taking your interaction with Lagrangian and running as a power series in phi, in the Wilson action, nothing tells you to stop. You know, you could have phi to the n, you could have phi to the n times 2 derivatives of phi. All possible polynomials of phi and its derivatives are in the Wilson action. And so in each one of the coefficient of each one of those is a coupling constant, and they all depend on lambda. And so this is telling you in one fell swoop how they're all related to each other as you change lambda. And what Polchinski shows in his paper is that in that infinite dimensional coupling constant space, so you've got, you know, infinite number of axes, of which I've gone 3. This is like coupling constant 1. So what I'm doing is I'm imagining I'm running S interaction as a sum of, you know, a coupling constant. I guess I use E for something else. Let's call it G1 times 5 cubed plus G2 times 5 to the 4th plus G3 times 5 squared box 5 to the 8th, something like that. But just anything you want to write here. These things are all depending on lambda. If I took this functional equation I've written and I extended it in all possible operators, I can translate it into a bunch of differential equations that relate these couplings to one another as a function of lambda. And what Plotinsky shows is that in this space coupling, as you come down in energy, you approach some sort of a surface, which is lower dimensional, you know, finite dimensional surface. And in his case, it's 3-dimensional surface. The couplings flow for small lambda onto the approach asymptotically a surface. So lambda goes to 0. And so all these interactions are non-zero in general. But what happens is that because they're effectively lying on a 3-parameter surface, you only have to specify 3 things and you know what they all are. All the couplings are. All these effective interactions are. And that's the statement of renormalizability, that there's only a fixed small number of things you have to choose in order to completely specify what the interactions of the theory are. So Plotinsky is playing. As lambda is 0, coupling in this in the picker theory he was looking at, the lambda phi four. For a real scalar field, not lambda phi four. For a finite dimensional. So that means you need only specify a few parameters. No. Showing that is like you're showing that this is theory is normalizable. In the sense that there's only a few number of things you need to specify to get all the quantum results. Yeah, all the ones that are that we are looking very small trigger. Yeah, all the ones in that sense, right? But in this derivation, I'm taking all these like just like all the current for turned off.
All the little graphs, let's bring that down, those are all fixed. If I started seeing current dependence, then they are never failing, right? So
that's an example of what the cutoff version of the Wilson action is good for. The way he makes his argument is actually very geometrical, and it's not such a very physical way of thinking about renormalizability, which is very different from what the approach in the 50s and 60s, where the logic was the same. You wanted to show that you could, that in the limit that you had a cutoff, which is very, very large, so you've got the scales that you're ignoring is very high compared to the scales of which it's used. You wanted to show that as that went to infinity, only a finite number of things had to be adjusted in a cutoff-dependent way to make everything else fine. That was what you were doing in the 60s for showing the normalizability, and that kind of involved knowing how graphs diverge and proving that even though you've got multidimensional graphs and you're at very high numbers of loops, they basically normally behave as if they were one-dimensional intervals, and so you can kind of use dimensional analysis to understand their large momentum limit, which is more like what Weinberg's theorem is. And this is kind of a much more physical way of thinking about that. It has drawbacks. It's difficult to think about gauge theories in this way. Things that have symmetries that cut off light to break are kind of complicated to formulate this way. So it's not clear that that's useful there, but it conceptually really captures the normalization in a very, very nice and physical way.
The gauge theory is more or less, if you think of the way he's doing this.
You know, I'm motivated that you wanted to cut things off by actually putting in a momentum dependent function of make the quadratic part momentum dependent so that function shows. Imagine that you tried to do that. Just do the function. In position space, imagine writing that position space, and what you would have had is the quadratic action would have been, you know, 5x some function of box divided by lambda squared. It would have been minus box plus m squared times some operator of p inverse of box over lambda squared. I would have had the propagator would have been some function of box, and then this would be the inverse function. This is in an operator sense, just because if I'm multiplying things in momentum space, then I'm really kind of devolving them into position space. So if you think about it now, gauge invariance says that everywhere you see a derivative, you're supposed to put in a gauge potential. So here you would have said, well, box, what that really means is not partial mu, partial mu. That could really be partial mu times I e a mu, partial mu times I e a mu. Otherwise, it's not gauge invariance. But now you have to do that here, too. So as soon as you do this in the unperturbed interacting, you now also are drawing a whole bunch of cut off the kind of interaction. because everywhere there's an A here, I would have thought that's the same direction. And so you're making a correlated statement amongst all the, anything which punishes you for having high versus low momentum, that's something which has to also depend on the gauge field. And so it's, another way of saying that is that you can't, in a gauge invariant way, if you cut things off, you'll find that you've ruined the gauge invariant of the thing you were testing. Because what you did, if you just cut things off, you effectively, even though you might have replaced this with covariate derivatives, you effectively just replaced this by an ordinary derivative. And that was a big deal. So you'll find that when you do a calculation, you're being punished for that. And so these gauge dependent, the gauge field dependent and cutoff functions will be things that were in your interactions and they're designed to be there to restore gauge invariance. So that if you had calculated with a cutoff, you would have found you broke gauge invariance. But the things you need to add to fix it are all the things that you would have gotten by making a simple variance problem. So you can do that, but it's just as hard because you have to kind of go through systematically and figure out what those things were. Whereas you could, if it's more convenient, what's nice about dimensional regularization is that the regularization is gauge invariant. So you're making your integrals finite in a way which is manifested gauge invariant every step of the way. So you don't have to actually then worry about fixing it by adding things. You don't have to add things to your Lagrangian and order by order and some coupling constant that are not gauge invariant in such a way that they're fixing the damage you did with your regularization. Dimensional regularization will be all you want.
Those are a separate thing. So that's if you have a gauge theory and you're choosing a gauge, then there'll be an issue of ghosts that you have to have to because your answer doesn't pair in the gauge. But the ghosts are there to show that the answer doesn't depend on what gauge you chose. That'll be there no matter what happens, but that's but then in addition to that, all your intervals are diverging and you have to regulate them. And so it just pays you to regulate them in a way which is explicit gauge theory. So that you can how much regularization is not costing you any. It's not making it hard to see what's going on. Because the way we're acting and proceed is when I want to write down the list of action, what I'll do is I'll write down what's the most general thing that's on the lab right now. And gauge invariance would be an important part of that. And then I'll say, well, I've got some unknown coefficients. I'll choose those coefficients by comparing to some calculation in the full theory. But if I didn't have gauge invariance, I'd have to actually write down all possible non-gauge invariant interactions too, knowing that they're all going to actually cancel each other out. But I'd have to figure out what they are and work that much harder to get an answer which I knew was gauge invariant anyway. So if you just do the calculation in a dimensional regularization, you never force to deal with all these constants that are not comparing your answer. Any other questions? All right.
So that's all I want to say about the exact normalization group. It's like mostly just these notes that. Now let me describe, in the example we've been following, how to calculate, I want to calculate part of the effective action, the Wilson action, the one loop, and I want to do it in dimensional regulation, so I want to do what's called the matching calculation. So, the thought is that cutoffs are inconvenient for several reasons. Several reasons are mentioned. Because the first thing they do is they introduce large scale lambda. That is in intermediate steps. That are not in the answer, physical quantity. And that's bad because it complicates dimensional analysis. And the second thing is that it breaks gauge invariance. And general covariance and things like that. What are you looking to see? And so dimensional regularization does not do these two things, and so that's why it's such a useful with an attractive scene view. So to avoid these, avoid them. And the puzzle is that sounds like it's something which the face value doesn't make sense from an effective design point of view. Happens, makes sense. So the issue is, you know, you have some in momentum space, you have some integrals. Could be in position space too, because you can regulate the integrals using the width parameterization of the propagators. And the divergences you see, you get to integrate in dimensional regularization. So basically what's going on is that in dimensional regularization, the kind of problems that you hit in Feynman graphs and momentum space would be that you have integral d squared p, and you have some rational function of p. So you have some polynomial 1 of p, some polynomial 2 of p. And they have the property that for large p, they're not falling fast enough to make the thing converge. Polynomials P1, P2 are such that P1 over P2 does not fall faster than 1 over P to the 4th at large P. And because of that, the thing is diverging from large p. So the dimensional regularization idea is you say, well, so let's integrate over all momenta, but we can define, well, we'll do this in n dimensions, and we'll regard n as being some not an integer, but it's not a positive integer, just some complex number. And we'll think of the thing as a function of n. So if you do this for n, so we'll think of this as being an integral. It depends on n, and it could also depend on some, maybe it depends on external momentum, let's say. So it just depends on q, but it also now depends on n. And we'll take the limit n goes to 4 at the end of the day. And that sounds like that's not very useful to start off with, except that this criterion that this thing falls off like 1 over p to the 4th is dependent on the number of dimensions we have. So typically what will happen is that if you have sufficiently small, if the bigger n is, bigger positive values, real values n has, the faster this whole thing has to fall to converge to large p. And the smaller n is, the less strong is the condition of how this thing has to fall to large p. So in particular, if n was, you know, large and negative, then this thing could actually be growing to large p, and it's not really a problem for large p limit. And so the thinking is that you can define this integral as a function of n, complex n, such that it's going to converge for sufficiently large negative real n, and then you can define it for all the rest of the n by analytic continuation. And then once you've done that, it'll typically diverge as n goes to 4, but that'll be a pole in the complex plane, and you can identify that pole, and that's how you've regulated the integral. You never take n quite to 0, to 4, you take it to be 4 minus epsilon, and follow things as a function of epsilon, and the things that diverge as epsilon goes to 0 will be the things you'll call your divergence. And so that's dependence on this pole, n minus 4, will be the analog of the dependence on the cutoff, lambda, is the way that works. So the idea is something like that. So expect I n q squared q to converge large p if n is sufficiently negative. So if real n is sufficiently negative. Define I am a Q complex. It's a function. Complex and my analytic continuation from the equation. And typically what you're doing is you know, in practice the integrals you tend to be doing are integrals of t squared, you know, some polynomial t squared t squared. And those are looking like gamma functions when you write them. So the functions you typically get are for simple functions, and they do tend to have these poles as infinite poles. So the right n is equal to 4 minus epsilon, and ask for limiting behavior. As epsilon goes to 0. And you get poles. Typically, the world in one of the plots. And those are the what's nice is no dimension so far, right? We didn't introduce a dimensionless scale yet. So you're going to get dimensionless factors of 1 over n minus 4, and that means that the dimensionality thing is not going to get complicated. Now, that's not quite right because it's deceptive. You know, you can't get, there's no free lunch at some level, except for here on one side. So it appears as if there are no scales to do. Which is attractive from the point of view of dimensional analysis. But what you have to keep in mind is that once you go to n dimensions, all your couplings in your Lagrangian have a different dimension, engineering dimension, than they had before. So all your couplings have different engineering dimensions. So for example, with a scalar field, I had my Lagrangian, my action as being integral dnx, you know, minus 1/2 d phi minus lambda 5/4 there. We're used to thinking that in four dimensions, phi has dimension, has engineering dimension of mass because the action had to be the same dimension as h-bar. And if we're using units for h bar and t is 1, then the action is dimensionless. But this measure in four dimensions was length to the fourth. So this should have been 1 over length to the fourth, or mass to the fourth. Derivative is 1 over length, so 2 of those is 1 over length squared, so each phi had to be 1 over length to make this whole thing dimensionally right, given there's no constant here, or dimensionable. Once you know this is 1 over length, this is 1 over length to the fourth, so that says that lambda is dimensionless. So that argument would have said in four dimensions, lambda is dimensionless. But in n dimensions, everything changes because this has changed, so the fields are going to have different dimensions and so on. So in n dimensions, so in four dimensions, phi goes like 1 over length, and lambda goes like length to 0. But in n dimensions, phi has to go like, this has to go like 1 over length to the nth, so this has to go like, this is going like length to the nth, this is going like 1 over length to the nth, but it might have two factors of 1 over length I get rid of, so phi has to go like 1 over length to the n minus 2 divided by 2, so that's altogether n over 2 minus 1. So if n were 4, this would be 4 over 2 is 2 minus 1 is 1, and that's the reason that. But now that means that phi to the fourth goes like this to the fourth power, so that'll be 2n minus 4. So lambda has to go like So it should have been altogether we wanted length to the minus n. Then we had to subtract off by the fourth place. We have to subtract off minus 2n plus 4. That's 4 minus 3n is wrong. So what I do want to know. But I said, so 5 to the 4th. Oh, I forgot. I know what it is. This is 1 over length to this. So this is length to the 1 minus n over 2. So 5 to the 4th would have been length to the this whole sign is wrong. This has been plus and minus. That's n minus 4. So together that's n minus 1. So we can check that. For n equals 4 is 0, but if we take, let's take n equals 6, say. For n equals 6, we would have got length squared, and that's right, because we had in 6 dimensions, then phi should have been mass squared, because 2 of them would be mass to the 4th, and 2 more would be mass to 6. So this would be then mass to 8, so this has to be 1 over mass squared. It had to be linear n, because this is linear n. So that means that there's really a scale hidden in your problem. Things that you thought were dimensionless actually have dimensions of length. Some power. So what people typically do is they write a fictitious length there. So let's write, so in n dimensions, let me call it Ln and L4, right? Lambda n as being lambda 4 times mu to the 4 minus n. Some mass scale. And you can do that. You can factor a power of mu to the 4 minus n from any coupling in the problem, thereby arranging that the in n dimensions the coupling has the same dimensions as you used to thinking about it having in 4 dimensions. But then everything will depend on mu. And so it sounds like the good feature that things don't depend on this new scale, our new scale is wrong because there's really mu dependence. But the important thing is that as mu goes to 4, as n goes to 4, your dependence on mu is all logarithmic. So as n goes to 4. So what we're supposed to do is write, we're going to get factors of mu to the 4 minus n to some power p, whatever x is. But if we write n is equal to 4 minus 2 epsilon, then 4 minus n will be 2 epsilon. So this will be mu to the n 4 minus n times p will be mu to the 2 epsilon p. And as epsilon goes to 0, that is e to the 2 epsilon p log mu. And so the series for that would be expressed off as being 1 plus 2 epsilon p log mu plus powers of log mu. Epsilon log mu. So this new scale mu that you're introducing, it's there. But the important thing is it's only appearing in logarithmically, and it's not appearing as an explicit power of mu. So from the purposes of dimensional analysis, it's not a problem. So that doesn't, but I haven't got to the point, which is why is this making sense for dimensional regularization? I wanted to first, if you weren't familiar with dimensional regularization, remind you how it works so you see why there's the issue there. So mu enters only through log, and so there's not going mental off at that point. But the problem is that these integrals you're doing, the integration now is going from minus infinity to infinity. And so from the conceptual point of view, if this Wilson action was supposed to be discriminating against high frequencies, it looks like you've not done that. Because if you're making your integrals converge because you're continuing to complex dimension, you actually included all possible lambda here. So all the loops are going to see all the frequencies in the problem, including all the high frequencies in the problem. So it looks like you've not done what your Wilson action was designed to do. So the problem, in a sense, integral DNP runs over all length And there's a similar statement in position space. Do you want to do it in position space? Including equals infinity. How can we remove my frequency to get the local maximum? And the answer is actually really easy, because the spirit of the Wilson action is that the heavy particles, whatever they were, could be described by some local operators in the low energy theory, as long as you're working to some power in 1 over the heavy mass. So the statement there is that no matter what you do at high energy, you can describe it at low energy in terms of some local operator. And so in particular, if you're wrong about what's going on at high energies because you've included momentum you shouldn't have included, the amount by which you're wrong can also be described by some local operators in your effective theory. And so there will always exist some choice of coupling constants which will remove the amount by which you've overcounted things by including the high frequency parts of your looping results in dimensional regularization. So since the way we're going to calculate the Wilson action is not by explicitly doing the integrals, what we're going to do is we're going to say, well, what's the most general couplings I could have had? And we'll take those couplings and we'll get them by calculating something explicit and asking what coupling, what value for the coupling in the effective theory captures the answer in the full theory to some fixed order 1 over m. Since I'm defining those couplings by matching to some physical calculation, I don't need to worry about what the extra. So part of that came from doing this integral. Part of it came from undoing the part of the high frequency part of the integral. I never have to actually do that calculation because I'm going to directly touch the case and ask what's the coupling. What couplings give me the answer that reproduces the full theory? So the matching, the calculation of Wilson actions by matching, which is what I'm going to do for you, is much more efficient because it doesn't go through this whole song and dance as to exactly the difference, what's high frequency, what's low frequency. How do you correct for the fact that the dimensional regularization is including momenta that are high frequency? Because it just includes the whole answer that you need for physical calculations and doesn't break it into its pieces, which are all irrelevant. So the logic you'll use, but if you have a particle whose mass is large, then if a particle has a mass which is bigger than the scale you're trying to ignore, then you don't want any of its momenta in the low energy theory. So what should happen in dimensional regularization is that if you're interested in energies above the mass of some particle, you could write an effective theory which has that particle in it, but keep all possible momenta right up to infinity and dimensionally regularize things. But if you're interested in a particle whose mass is bigger than the scale you're trying to get rid of, you shouldn't keep that particle at all. The effective theory should not include that particle because it's not in any of the states you're setting off with, and its effects are all being described by local interactions involving the low energy particles. So the way you should think about a Wilson action for dimensional regularization is that until you cross a threshold where you pass the scale little lambda through the mass of the particle, the action doesn't really change. All the couplings might renormalize in some way logarithmically, but it's the same field content at all energies between two mass thresholds. But as soon as you kind of go past, you bring your scale below the mass of a particle, which is a mass threshold, then you can define a new effective theory, which is the old one without that particle, and then ask what interactions do I need in this new theory to capture the effects of that particle that's no longer in this theory. And when you're doing that comparison, you'll do both those calculations in dimensional regularization, which you can renormalize in your favorite way. And the difference between the full theory and the theory without the particle will be some will be the thing that the effective interactions in the low energy theory are captured. So I'm going to do that explicitly so you see in detail what I mean. But the upshot is, just to finish this thought here, the amount of the error you make by including these high frequencies or high momenta, just like everything else at high energies, can be absorbed into some local effective interaction, which you're trying to figure out anyway. You never have to calculate it. You temper thing. If you compute LW by matching in the way I'm going to describe, so this is the thing I haven't made precise yet, but I will in this example. Let's go back to the toy model. So, so these kind of in practice issues of how you calculate the Wilson action are easy to see if you just do an explicit example and see how things work. Toy model. Remember what that toy model was? It was. Well, the grounds, you remember, had two fields, light and heavy. And so they were kinetic then. The mass terms, one was small, and one was quite large. And then there were various interactions. So everything was designed to be invariant under L goes to L minus L, L goes to minus L. We have, minus 1 over, if you remember it, the cubic comes first, so minus 1 over 3 factorial, pH m cubed, minus 1 half m fiddle l squared h, minus 1 over 4 factorial, pH plus, minus 1 over 4 factorial, you know, l over 4, minus 1 over 4, L the invariant under L goes to minus L. In principle, it could be plus a constant, but I'm always going to. I didn't write it down from something linear. When things linear in the field, I could shift into shifting the field so that the field is extended around zero, minimum. And I'm assuming that's been done before, saying it's going to be there. All right, so we did this calculation as to what the one particle irreducible generator was, the pre and one loop order for the low numbers of derivatives when we integrate out the heavy field. And what I want to do now is calculate what the Wilson action could be to some low order in 1 over m. Before I forget, you can all know that I'm running a, you know, this week and next week, because of the CDC thing, they've got our room book. That's why we're down here, this week and next week. And it also means that we couldn't find a book, room to book for the afternoon class. So my plan was to run a little bit late in the morning, and then we'll just cover the afternoon class. And also next week. So given that, I don't know how you feel about if you need a break for it. Yeah? You want to take a 5-minute break, and then what I'll do is then when we come back, I'll go until 12:30.